let's get to our next two guests. Been excited about this idea since I had it, to bring Professor Eric Siegel and Professor Aaron Carroll on the program. Dr. Aaron Carroll, who is also a professor at Indiana University. Eric Siegel, professor at Georgia State University. And I don't want to waste time listing all their credentials. Follow them both on Twitter. Learn more about them at Espen Siegel, at Aaron E. Carroll. Hey, guys. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, what's up?
Hi, Professor Siegel.
Good morning. Who was watching the World Series of Poker last night to 1:18 in the morning?
Ugh. The old man?
I was. Absolutely great, exciting stuff.
I'm glad you hit him right away because we were gonna take. Yeah, we're gonna. He's ignoring you, but we have a clip from when he wasn't here. So you talked to him. You talked to him the same way to his face as you do behind his back. Let's play the clip from when we were talking to Aaron Carroll. Do I need to set this up? I don't think I do. Eric Siegel came was mentioned somehow. I don't think I need to set it. Go ahead and play it.
First off, I want to say happy birthday, Pete.
Oh, yeah. You're very thoughtful, man. Two days away. 39, yeah, sure. Baby. How old are you again, Aaron? 42?
42.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, anyway, love
you. Neither of us, got to say it, though. Neither of us is old as old man Siegel.
Oh, wow. Oh, that was from my birthday show.
I'll talk to you guys tomorrow. Thanks for having me on, Pete.
He knows that's with love. He knows it.
All right,
old man Siegel. Oh, my God. Okay.
That is really funny. Old man Siegel.
I wanted to get a fried Twinkie. I was at a North Georgia thing, and they had fried Twinkies, and I thought about you, and I really wanted to get it, and they were sold out.
That's because they're so popular. Well, although Twinkies are, I mean, it's funny because Twinkies were like the big thing in like 2003 when I first moved here. So in Indiana, they moved so far past that. But those things are gross.
Well,
they're not
good. This is actually 1949. But that's a different conversation.
guys.
The scary part is, Pete, when you were picking a clip, that wasn't the one I was expecting, which means that they're the worst things I've said.
Oh, no. Really? Oh, my goodness.
There's so much to get to with you guys, but I want to just kind of have a general conversation. Wherever it goes, it goes. But obviously, specifically, we're going to talk about the Halbig case, and we're getting the weeds a little bit on that. It's fascinating. It's important for everybody. But you know, I just want to pick up where we left off with some of the conversations that we've been having today and lately. But what do you guys think when someone says to you, and we have these conversations all the time, well, I'm fiscally conservative, socially liberal, whatever. What does that mean?
It
who
drives
isn't
my wife crazy? If I could, it drives Lynn absolutely crazy when people say that. Because,
why?
Well, because what they inevitably end up standing for is, you know, when people say that, they're usually pro-choice and sometimes pro-legalization of marijuana. You know, and they're a little bit anti the things that fundamental religious people want, but they are really, really, really skeptical of government spending, which at the end of the day hurts women and minority groups more than anybody else.
Right.
So it makes them crazy.
That's interesting. Pick up on that, Aaron. What do you mean?
Yeah, I take that to mean usually they just don't like the government spending money. That's what they mean. They just, and when you say you don't want government spending money, it's rarely about defense or anything else. It's usually about you know, welfare programs or Medicaid or Medicare or even just, you know, title, whatever, any kind of title spending, just trying to do things. So I think Eric is partially correct.
But it also doesn't really make
very much correct.
But it also doesn't really make that much sense, because when government spends money, that often can stimulate the economy in every way, especially when they spend money, when they give money to the people that we hate the most, the poor. That money is the most direct type of stimulus to the economy. So if you're going to support any kind of government spending, it would be the kind of government spending.
I think it's shorthand for, I'm really not a dick, but I do like dick policies.
Well, okay, so I'll say it more charitably. I think it sometimes is what libertarians like to think. In other words, that they're not into, like, sort of, you know, legalized oppression in any way, and they want freedom, theoretically, freedom as much as possible, but that also includes, you know, government getting out of everyone's way and not really taking their money or spending it. So it
but
is
I didn't
a
even,
charitable way to sort of...
Well, let's talk about libertarians for a moment. I don't even understand what it means to be a libertarian, and it also doesn't make a lot of sense. So, you know, we could probably, if you're liberal, you can often, there can be some overlap there. But I interviewed a guy named Rob Sarvis, who is running on as a libertarian in the Virginia Senate race.
Yep.
And we, when he got onto a couple of issues, like it really falls apart after a minute or two of talking with them about policy.
Yeah, I had a big Twitter war with some folks where I suggest where you know Ted Cruz is incredibly libertarian and I mean not Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, but he wants a federal personhood amendment.
Right. That's where it falls apart. That's where it's fake conservatism. That's why I said charitably, because it often is just fake conservatism where it's just trying to cloak it. But there are some. I actually have some friends who I would classify as pretty pure libertarians, where they are, you know, totally for legalization of marijuana, totally against, you know, totally pro-choice, totally, you know, everyone should get out of decisions, everyone should have freedom, you decide whatever you want, marry whoever you want, why is the government getting involved in marriage anyway? But they are also, you know, against any kind of government.
Hey, Aaron, when you have that conversation with smart folks, here's the question I'd like to get an answer to.
Yep.
And it may not be a totally fair question.
I have, because I'm sure I've had the discussion. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I understand starting from point zero, we're beginning a society, things are roughly equal, and we decide to have a libertarian-type government starting from scratch. You know, we can have that debate, and I don't think it's a frivolous one. But in a society where the rules have favored a certain set of people for 200 years,
yes.
How do you start on day one saying the government should get out when it's not a coincidence that the wealthy in this country are mostly rich white males? It is because of the rules set by government coercion. That's what I understand.
So these friends are not, you know, so scorched the earth that, you know, they this is their preferred set of policies, yet they recognize that some things are necessary. Like they're not, you know, a lot of them are doctors, for instance, and they're not into, like, we need to repeal Medicare tomorrow and we need to – it's sort of like, well, we recognize that there are some things the government has to do and that there, you know, that there have to be some laws and there have to be. So it is possible to have a discussion with them and it does come down to a reasonable – well, we'll have to agree that they have to do something. It is just often a disagreement as to how
– I would hope that something would be – and this is where it gets, I think, really complicated – undoing – a lot of things government has done in an anti-libertarian way that favors a very small group of people.
I wish I could say that I would agree with you. I wouldn't say that they all agree with you.
Well, here's one, though. I mean, the guy said, Rob Sarvis, you know, in terms of education, decisions for your children's education should be made as locally as possible, and they should be made by the parents. And I said, no. I mean, to some extent, you want ownership over the choices for your kids. But generally, we should allow education policy experts, educators, teachers. We should give them – it's a very nuanced conversation – but we should give them a lot of freedom and leeway onto how to teach our kids. Education policy experts can disagree on a number of different things, but in terms of generally how kids learn and how money is most well spent, we give a certain amount of leeway and respect to the experts on that issue. And he said – basically, he was saying, no, it should be up to the local municipalities and even the states and not the federal government. And why should we allow – why should you be in charge of, you know, buying your own appliances? You can do all the research to buy your own appliance, but not where your kids should go to school.
I'd argue a pure libertarian should be responsible for their child's own education, and they shouldn't depend on anyone else anyway. So if we want to make it that anyone can be responsible for, you know, you can go live in Montana, live on a farm, and teach your kids yourselves and have that right, I guess that's fine. The problem is that often the people who want it done at a local level also want to decide how to educate the other children in the district as well, and then they're making decisions for those people. They just hope that they have the majority to make those decisions, but they're often telling other people, well, you have to have your children educated in a way that you don't want.
Let me ask you this, switching gears a little bit here. Ebola is gone in America for the time being. It could come back. But
wait. I went to the doctor a couple of days ago.
Uh-oh, Siegel's got Ebola.
I'm highly contagious. It's that old man disease. But I did notice on the door of my doctor's office this big sign that said, if you or anyone in your family has been exposed to anyone who has the Ebola virus, and I thought, in Atlanta, there's no one in Atlanta, Georgia, who's been exposed.
There's no one in the United States. No one.
Well, wait, Atlanta. That is where the CDC is, though, right?
But Aaron, I thought that was really crazy. I mean, it's a big sign. If you've been exposed to the Ebola virus, please contact someone immediately.
But Atlanta is where the CDC is at Emory, so that's not crazy.
This is a disease that has now been eradicated for the moment from the United States. It doesn't even exist. The fact that we're spending money to print
it is crazy.
Well, Why did it say if you have pneumonia? If you have pneumonia, please contact someone. It's much more dangerous, right? I mean, much more probable, right?
Or measles, or pick a disease. It's like
Alfred. No, but Alfred is representing.
I'm just saying. Look, it's a weird sign, sure, but to say it's in Atlanta, that actually is. I mean, that's where the CDC is. So people are dealing with Ebola at the CDC. Maybe not anymore. I'm just saying that's not the weirdest thing. If that was in Minnesota, it's not the weirdest. That makes the conversation preposterous. Then to say that's the craziest thing in the world.
The conversation is
not
preposterous.
But it's absolutely
the
not the craziest thing in the world.
Conversation.
Of course, it's weird. They probably shouldn't have had that sign.
Please tell Alfred why
they shouldn't have had that sign. But see, no. There's nuance to this. They probably shouldn't have had that sign. Clearly, there is a public outcry that they want the sign, so they have the sign, and it's not the weirdest thing in the
world.
There's
no public outcry
that it's in Atlanta. That's all I'm saying. To say that's the craziest thing in the world, that's preposterous, and that lowers, I think, the level of discourse when it comes to something
like
this.
No, the level of discourse got absurd.
I think you can simply say, actually, the odds of that happening are very low. They don't need that sign. Moving on.
Wait, who said the craziest thing in the world, though?
That's what Pete said.
Well, again, why are we debating what Pete says? I mean, really.
That's a great point.
I'm not going to argue with Pete about Ebola.
Phenomenal
point.
Who's Pete? I forgot. My Alzheimer's kicking in. Who's Pete? Sorry. I'm going to make old man jokes all hour because you guys deserve
it. Good. Own it.
Oh, no. They're always funny.
Yeah, they are. They're usually hurtful. Okay, but just the conversation and the fear did reach a fever pitch. It was absurd. It did influence the elections. It was.
Wait, Alfred, I do want to say one thing to you. So I have a good friend who was the deputy director of the CDC, and now she actually runs one of the centers there. And a lot of my law students have worked for the CDC. I mean, CDC is a huge employer in Atlanta. And I was at a party the other night with like 25 CDC people. And we had this conversation because I mentioned it. And they said, and I'm sure Aaron will confirm this, that at the door of my doctor's office, there are so many things that are more almost everything is more dangerous to me than Ebola, even in Atlanta, Georgia. Almost everything. Yep.
I agree 100%. You are 100% correct.
Which is why
here's
it's
the
crazy.
Problem. No, here's the problem is that if you are maybe on the fence and scared of Ebola in Atlanta, there's, I'm sure, a lot of people who are. And I think they're off base and completely wrong. But here's the thing. They think that the more we say they're stupid, the more they're going to galvanize and think there might be some kind of weird conspiracy and that our government's handling this
here.
Poorly.
I
think there's a better way to communicate this than just calling them stupid and the whole thing crazy.
I feel like I'm coming into a fight between Pete and Alfred like I do with married couples.
Well, what do you think about it, though, Aaron?
I think I would.
Putting a sign up to warn of a thing that is the least dangerous is.
I think it's a credible waste of money and space, and it does more harm than good.
Me too. All right. Sorry, Alfred. I love you.
And everyone who disagrees is stupid. And that's why our country will probably move forward, correct?
No, it's not. I'm not
saying we need to learn how to talk to each other. We should tell them that sign is maybe incorrect and invalid, but I'm saying that's not going to help anything because they're not going to believe you. They're simply not going to believe you.
My wife read a long article the other day that suggested, I'm not taking a position on this bold claim, that a lot of the Ebola stuff was generated by Republicans before the election. That's why it's going to go away now, because it creates the image of Africa and black people, and it really was used in that way to scare Americans.
I take a much less cynical view. I think that the media enjoys the panic du jour. And that you know, whatever it is, we did it with SARS, we did it with I had friends who pediatricians, mind you, and pediatric researchers who refused to come to Seattle when the Pediatric Academic Society meeting was in Seattle because they become so frightened by the media about SARS years ago when that was. And of course, how many people died of SARS? Zero in the United States. Canada and Australia have enacted travel bans against Ebola. This is not a U.S. thing. This is the way I think the developed world and modern media reacts to stuff. It is a way to gain, interest, and they scare people and they get everyone riled up. Think about that plane that went down, the Malaysian plane that went down, and how much news coverage was devoted to that. And we're off Ebola. We're on to the next thing. They will find the next thing.
I think technically I'm being an incredibly jerky law professor here. The plane went missing. We don't even know if it went down.
No, you're okay. Okay, there you go. So missing, but I'm saying they will find their next object. I think that this was.
Well,
the
here's one.
I don't think it was. I don't think it was because it was Africa. I do think, however, that politicians did seized upon it because it was a way to project government competence.
I will change.
See, Yeah, every time putting I see Obama's Katrina, I roll my eyes because it's like, you know, no people who were infected in the United States died, and we've already eradicated it. If
no people died, no people lost their homes, except one lady in Maine, and it was her choice. Right. Now, here I will say that I understand what Alfred is saying about language and saying calling someone crazy. Anybody, I'll change it. Anybody who puts up a sign and warns of a thing that shouldn't be warned of is perpetuating fear and incredibly irresponsible. Now, moving on. The FBI has its new figures out about violent crime in the United States of America.
Yep.
Violent crime is dramatically down.
Yep.
Their Crime in the United States report shows murder and non-negligent manslaughter down 4.4%. Listen, murders, rapes, robberies and other categories of violent crime are down. But this is just in your wheelhouse, Aaron, and certainly yours as well, Professor Siegel, in that the truth is that crime is down. But because it's the news, frankly, it's their job to report when a woman is murdered or abused. That's their job. It's not their job to report that a woman came home from work and enjoyed dinner with her family. But that's the obviously, overwhelmingly, that's what's happening. But people think there's more violence, but there isn't. It's way down, and that's great.
This is the same. I would make the exact same argument that I was just talking with Eric about Ebola. It's the media's job to find the panic du jour. You know, you would think, given media coverage of the way that they cover teens and the internet and everything else, that all kids do today is have sex and sext and you know get on the internet and see porn.
What's
and everything
that?
Else. They would
what's
ignore
sex?
The fact that
the internet
teen pregnancy is at an all time low for recording it. Teen births are at an all time low. Teen abortions are at an all time low, and even teens engaging in sex are decreasing significantly. It's like, you know, but that doesn't make the news.
Yeah, Pete, and I think Aaron's exactly right as always, and almost always. And also, I've been doing a lot of thinking about the media recently for this other project I'm doing, and I have to say this. So CBS, ABC, and NBC back in the good old days of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you know, they did want to make a profit, but they were filled with people who had a kind of ethic about what they were reporting on that just is not a part of today's world, and that makes a big difference. It just does. I mean, it's not just the 24-hour news cycle, so they have to fill the day. It's not just that. It's that all the news media today, and I'm talking about newspapers, television, and social media, are owned where the bottom line profit motive is so disproportionate to let's do our job well that everything that is done now is to make the most money, and that's cute. And so
right, but,
the question
but
they ask is, what's going to make us the most money, not what's most important?
But let's be clear that when we're talking about what people are afraid of and what the media does, the you know, what do you call it, the panic du jour?
Yeah.
I
saw that from Colbert. He actually said that when I was on a show. I loved it.
Oh, really?
Never said
waited for you to work in that you're on a show. And so
they do credit. God damn you.
They are supposed to report when a plane goes down or goes missing. It's how and how long, et cetera. Look, forget about the Malaysian plane, you know, the plane that landed on the river. A plane that goes down. They are supposed to report on all these things. It's just the way that they do and the amount of time they spend on it, the graphics, the music, and the tone with which they do it is wildly irresponsible, which is why I'm so proud that we're not on ratings-driven media. It is corporate media, but it's not ratings-driven media here on SiriusXM, so we don't have to worry about that, and we have a much smarter conversation. Everybody is killing us on Twitter for talking about libertarians without having a libertarian.
Well, okay, we only talked about libertarians for all of 2 seconds.
We didn't talk about Ebola. I don't have Ebola. I don't know.
we weren't, like, making the show about libertarians. I was just making a point.
No, I did that. But
I do have to say, Pete, though, that I do think the omnipresent agenda of MSNBC and Fox News is such a distortion. And leaving us, and I understand the point you're making that we never hear good, only hear bad. But the problem goes so much deeper. I was watching, I watch Fox News all the time so that I'm aware of what they're saying and who they're speaking to. And someday someone's going to be just aghast and amazed this happened. And we have a major, dominant, most successful news channel that is basically like a propaganda arm, like the old Soviet Union had, except not of the government, but of one particular political party and one particular
or ideology.
Business. And that's just incredible. I mean, I know smart people who say to me, yeah, Fox News is the best place to go for my news. And I say to them, but it's like the old, you know, Kremlin propaganda arm. They have a goal and an objective, and it's overriding. That's a big deal. You downplay it.
Let's go to Doug.
Okay, I want to back. While I'm not going to argue with a lot of what Eric just said, hands down, the most sane thing I saw about the entire bull scare was said by Shep Smith on Fox News.
And that can happen.
On that clip, it was fantastic.
Yeah.
I tweeted and posted it, and it was absolutely the best reporting and sort of editorializing that I saw about the entire insanity while it was going on.
I don't mind,
by the way,
I mind the fact they call O'Reilly, Hannity, and that awful, terrible, evil woman at 9 o'clock, Megyn Kelly. They call them news shows. That's the problem.
She is not worse than Sean Hannity.
No, no one's worse than Sean Hannity. That's a different conversation.
I think he's.
I think of all
Ted Cruz. I'm not Ted Cruz. I mean, I'm Karl Rove. Karl Rove is worse than Sean Hannity, but no one else.
Doug in New Jersey.
Good morning. I wanted to ask Professor Siegel if he had heard the comments that Scalia made about the Constitution says nothing that we can't about that we can't use Christian values to make laws in our country or something to that effect.
Yeah, he actually said it several times. He said it recently, and partly that's because I have to say this very carefully. Scalia is making even more outrageous public comments than you might remember. A year ago, he said he believed in the devil. Most Americans believed in the devil. And he criticized the person who asked the question, saying, you're from New York, you don't understand America, and you don't understand the devil. I think Scalia is at the – I say this. I don't think he's playing with all the cards he used to play with. And that's a very, very, very – I can't prove it. He was in Atlanta last year, and he and I had a public exchange, and I was sitting right next to the Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times, and Scalia got Shelby County wrong in front of 500 people. He just got it wrong, 100% incorrect. The stuff about religion not being prohibited by the Constitution or anything like that, you know, the First Amendment does say that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, and that applies to the states. He's saying all kinds, but really, we don't have to go any further than, of course, I believe in the devil, doesn't everybody understand who that man is?
Right. Well, how can you remove a Supreme Court? Do they have to be impeached?
You can't. So I'll give one quick example. Justice Douglas, who was a liberal, the most liberal Supreme Court justice for a long time, and a leading liberal figure. Justice Douglas had a stroke when he was on the Supreme Court, and it rendered him ineffective and unable to perform, and he refused to leave. And for 9 months, the Supreme Court decided on its own, seven of the eight justices decided, we're not going to decide any case where Justice Douglas' vote could be a swing vote or a vote that matters. Mm. And they basically hid it from the public. And he could not do his job for 7 or 8 months, and the people asked him to resign, he wouldn't do it. That's happened many, many, many times in Supreme Court history, and there's nothing we can do about it.
Personal question on the issue of good questions, Doug. You got Eric Siegel right in his wheelhouse. For you, though, Eric Siegel, are you effective and able to perform?
Absolutely not.
Well, that's sad to hear. I did not. There's Dr. Carroll, can you prescribe him anything?
No.
All right, here we go.
So the Scalia thing, though, there's one last thing about that.
All right.
That when he came to Atlanta last year, and I've seen him do this before, but it was just last year, he did 20 minutes. He gave a 20-minute talk, and then he took questions. And I've said this before on your show, Pete, but it's just true. He ranted and raved for 20 minutes about originalism and how the Constitution is not living. It's dead, it's dead, it's dead, it's dead. He kept saying, it's a dead Constitution. And he sounded just like Ralph Cramden. It sounded like Ralph Cramden screaming at Alice. And that's what he looked like. And I hope you get that reference. If not,
I was going to say, that just dated you so bad.
He's a bully. He's a huge, big bully. It's what he is.
Who, Aaron?
Ralph Cramden is lovable.
Ralph Cramden and Scalia.
Ralph Cramden is lovable.
Scalia's a little bit lovable, according to his clerks and people who like him, but he's not. He's an incredible bully. Sorry.
Let's go to Michael in Charleston, who I always love to take on the phone. When I see you call in, Michael, you go right on because you're way out there, in my opinion. Hey, Michael.
Hey.
With all due respect.
Hi. I think I'm tying in what the guest said earlier, the issue of evil and such. Justice Sotomayor was interviewed by Charlie Rose, and she actually, to my surprise, stated that there are people in the world that are just basically evil, that they cannot be reformed, and that was just taken away, because I thought her being a liberal would think that everyone's reformable, everyone can be saved. And your show is propaganda as much as Fox News is propaganda.
Well, so I'll be real quick about this. Sotomayor is a very interesting character. You know, she has such an amazing story growing up in the Bronx and poor, and it is. It's an amazing American success story. On the other hand, lawyers who practiced in front of her in the Second Circuit or the First Circuit where she was a judge, lawyers who practiced in front of her and people I trust and know who know her, she is kind of Scalia-like in her dogmatism and her bullying attitude. And you never hear that in the media, Pete, because that's not the good story, right? The good story is, you know, she grew up in the Bronx and blah, blah, blah. And it is a good story. But these
let me acknowledge. So my show, comparing this program to Fox News as a network, good luck, I guess, in terms of just comparing any one, you know, this is the difference. The main difference, I think, is the transparency of this program, meaning, I mean, listen, like, I don't bill myself as, I'm just an idiot. I'm just a guy with a radio program who invites really smart guys like my two guests on, policy experts. But the real big difference between Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, this program, which is on SiriusXM, is ratings. So when you don't have to worry about ratings, Michael, I don't know how to get this through to you, but when you don't have that as a concern, you can actually...
You don't have to worry about ratings?
I have... I don't have to worry about ratings at all, right?
Why is that? Because...
We don't have them. We don't have them. And my boss... I'm telling... You don't... I don't know if you would believe me or not, but no one really... There's no editorial interference with the program, but no one tells me what I have to do or not to, and I don't look at ratings. I mean, all of the networks have to worry about that and salvage. That's a huge burden to not
have. I'm sorry, Pete. Was Michael, were you suggesting that my bashing of Scalia was one-sided or unbalanced? Because nobody bashes the Supreme Court, liberals and conservatives in this country today, more than I do.
No, but he was saying this program is propaganda no different than Fox News, right? So, I mean
– right. And what's going on is that your program, okay, has a certain viewpoint. It's a viewpoint that people in Detroit have held, people in California have held, and what you propose.
When we talk about Ebola, and we talk about the fact, and I say that there's no Ebola left, that's not a viewpoint. That's just a fact.
That there's no what? Hold on.
No Ebola left in the United States. It's been eradicated. The panic was somewhat misplaced. Is that propaganda?
Is it a viewpoint?
That would be a viewpoint. That there's no.
All right. Thank you, Michael. I can't do it.
What was his point? I missed his point.
I don't know. That guy has been calling.
Because there is Ebola left, and I'm wrong, and that's a viewpoint. I don't understand.
I have a jar of it in my studio, but I don't talk about it because I don't need to get ratings. But the guy's been calling the program forever. I don't think we ever get through to each other, so I'm not even sure why I take his calls. But I try. Okay, Mario, get us started on the reason why Siegel and Aaron Carroll are on the program together today.
Geriatrics?
I'm a pediatrician. I can't help him.
Oh, my goodness.
Sorry, Eric. By the way, back to Michael's phone call, the problem with you guys, you liberals, is that you're so smug about Ebola being eradicated.
I was the exact same before as after. This is what I can't stand. It's like,
Aaron,
rewind the tape. You will hear me say exactly the same exact things when we were in the rage of the epidemic as I'm saying right now.
Aaron, it's a joke. But did you guys not see Rod Fournier's peak asshole tweet?
Oh, yes. You tweeted. Yes, I did see that.
Mario, are you in the room? You sound like you're like in my coffee.
Soul.
Or something, or whatever.
Tweet? What was Ron Fournier's tweet?
Ron Fournier says, "Who's more smug? Conservatives about election news or liberals about Ebola news? #Get over yourself."
Wow. Nice.
What a dick.
Because
why is that so dicky?
Go ahead, Aaron. I
would say because anyone now covering the fact that Ebola is gone is gloating. I mean, that's crazy, first of all. And secondly, I would argue that I'm saying the exact same things now that Ebola is gone that I was saying before, that this is an overreaction, that we have the systems in place to take care of this, that we are a developed nation with a robust public health system that is going to sort of get a handle on this. And we took tons and tons of calls that told me, what will I say when it's all over the place? And I said, it won't be, and I will say the exact same thing, and I am. And I find it interesting that, of course, all those people aren't calling back right now.
Just so you know that the hysteria is not quite over, I was watching CNN, I believe, yesterday, and they had made a quick reference to the doctor in New York finally being released and cured. That was about 30 seconds, followed by a five-minute report on ISIS possibly weaponizing Ebola. So,
okay. Well, the hysteria is not over because 48 hours ago, there's this, for the first time ever in my experience in 7 years at this doctor's office, there's a huge sign saying, if you have Ebola, you know, I mean, it was a huge sign.
If you know anything.
The problem also is that the Ebola crisis is not over. It's the exact same, and it's not worse in Africa, and we just, like, no one seems to cover or have the
60.
That is the greatest.
Did you hear about, did you all hear about 60 Minutes?
Oh, well, maybe, I mean, there might be some news.
No, listen. So 60 Minutes, Lara Logan, who just can't win because she just doesn't seem to care.
Scandal-ridden Lara Logan, that's my favorite.
Yeah, yeah. She never should have been brought back based on her awful reporting and the standard that 60 Minutes is supposed to hold. So they did a segment on Ebola in Africa,
mm-hmm.
and it got widely ridiculed because they didn't interview any Africans. They did not showcase any of the death. They did not. Yeah, they interviewed all white doctor. I didn't see it. I saw the criticism of it and a piece put together. It was.
Hey, Mayor, I have a quick 60 Minutes thing that I was personally involved in. When I was at the Department of Justice, there was a big case in Cincinnati where the Cincinnati Bell and high-ranking other officials and the mayor of Cincinnati were all alleged to be in this great conspiracy to wiretap phones.
Is this the Black Sox scandal?
Yeah, that's very funny. Ha, ha, ha. And just real quick, it was front-page news at the time, and 60 Minutes did a whole story about the plaintiff's complaint, and they as if it were true, as if the plaintiff's complaint, everything they said was, in fact, factual. When the complaint was dismissed, at the very early stage of the trial, for being completely, frivolous, they never once went back. And
was the plaintiff Alexander Graham Bell?
All right. Goodbye. See you guys tomorrow.
Anyway,
60 Minutes has always been. They do some good stuff, but it's incredibly slanted and edited, and no one should really take what they say is true.
Well, my point, which is back, is the single greatest Ebola threat to the United States is if we do not contain and get rid of Ebola in West Africa right now. If we don't take, if it spreads, if it becomes an epidemic, if it goes crazy, that is the greatest threat to the United States, not ISIS.
And you've always said that. You said that from day one, Eric.
Yeah. It's like no coverage, no concern. It's like, oh, Ebola's gone in the United States. This will go away. It will again be buried in the news. And there is a threat. There's a real threat to us. It is what's going on in Africa. And either we pay attention to it and get on top of it and help them take care of it because they're not going to be able to on their own. That's the threat. Stop worrying about ISIS. Stop worrying about illegal immigrants bringing it across the border. Stop worrying about getting it on a plane right now or on a bus or in the subway or anything else in the United States. The threat is in West Africa.
You know why that won't happen, Aaron, I think? And this is going to sound unbelievably elitist, so here's an elite alert here. It takes 2 points to make the point you just made. And that doesn't work in politics. It just doesn't. In other words, the points you're making are the biggest threat to us is the threat from West. If you can't say it in a sentence these days, it's very hard to enact policy.
And by the way, that takes us back to the ratings conversation, which is you don't, and I go on cable news all the time, and Siegel now does, and Aaron has a million times. And when you go on television, you have 3-minute conversations maybe. And where you're probably on a panel, you're only getting to speak for, 30, 45 seconds. And if you ever speak, by the way, for 30 seconds, they'll get in your ear and say, rap, rap, rap. And it happens all the time. It's happened to all of us and mostly to Aaron because he does not shut up.
Pete, I will say this. I'm not self-promoting here, but I've had that experience on all of the cable shows you're talking about. But on Monday, I did a local news show here on the Supreme Court cell phone tower case because it came out of Roswell, Georgia. And
wow.
Actually, we did a five-minute segment, just he and me, where we talked, you know, as a conversation for 5 minutes. And I thought,
well, the bottom,
why can't national news be this way? This sounds
well, because it won't get ratings, because our attention spans. The point is, the conversations that I have with you guys individually when you're on, they are oftentimes an hour. The problems are huge. Huge. And they need a lot of explanation, which is why I have the both of you on, because you're experts on them. And when we come back from our break, we're going to talk
about. Anyway, Pete.
Pete.
What's that? Yes.
Can I stay on the line? I have a question about King Burwell.
Yeah. Yep. Hold on. We'll be right back with you and Professor Eric Siegel and Aaron Carroll at Aaron E. Carroll at E. Spin Siegel. And the caller is Mario. He's on Twitter at Mario J. Russo. We'll come back and talk about the future of the Affordable Care Act, what the Supreme Court taking this case means for both health policy and legally. That's why these guys are here. We'll be right back.
Hey guys, it's me, Sean, again, the voiceover guy. Yeah, all good's with me, thanks. How are you? All right, well, the show's starting, so I guess I'll talk to you later. Stand Up with Pete Dominic.
All right, we are back here on Stand Up, joined by Dr. Aaron Carroll, who's a health policy expert and a pediatrician, and he writes books that debunk myths, as well as Professor Eric Siegel, who is joining us from Atlanta, where he is a professor at Georgia State University, and he also writes books and articles about constitutional law, and mainly he ridicules, criticizes, and takes to task the Supreme Court. And if, I mean, liberal, conservative, it doesn't matter where you come from on the spectrum, you'll love both these guys' books, because they aren't actually overtly political. Certainly Aaron's aren't, and I would argue that Professor Siegel's book, Supreme Myths, isn't either. And guys, you should both be flattered that now I'll be doing my Skype hits for cable news in my home studio, with the backdrop often maybe my bookcase, and your books are both prominently featured.
And they both have myths in the title. What a coincidence is that?
Woo! Look at that.
Look at that.
All right, Mario, you held on through the break, and you wanted to ask, but what did you want to ask? You're going to steer me wrong here.
No, I was going to ask about King v. Burwell. Well, how the same thing. If Eric wants to give a rundown of it, just to catch people
what does
up,
that have to not. Do with health? How, where's health policy? What am I missing? Or can you do
that? Is health is this well, in fact, well, it's going to
significant.
I was just reading.
Okay, no. How big? I get, but King Burwell's at the same thing. I'm confused.
Thing. Pete, King is the case the Supreme Court granted cert on. King is the case they're hearing. King is the case they're going to reverse.
They're all the same though.
And King is the case that Aaron. Last time we were on the show, you were suggesting two things, I think. I think Mario will get to your point. Yeah. You said two things. You were less pessimistic than I was about what the Supreme Court was going to do here. I am telling you the Supreme Court is going to reverse and declare the sub. I mean, they wouldn't have granted cert in this case if they weren't going to do that, unless one of them chickens out at the last moment. But more importantly, I was reading this thing by 49 economists yesterday, or I read it yesterday, that were saying this actually is a really big deal.
Austin was actually one of those economists.
Right. And it was very simple. If it
is Austin Frakt blogs with Aaron Carroll at the Incidental Economist.
I'm not arguing. I have no way I'm not arguing. I'm not saying it's a big deal. Okay. Millions of people would immediately lose the subsidies and health insurance would become more so. It's just that, you know, there are gradations of big deal. I don't think this would kill the ACA.
No, okay. But it's.
Not accepting the Medicaid expansion in all the 50 states in the United States is a big deal. It also didn't kill the ACA.
These economists, and I'm not going to argue with you on this because I don't know, but these
economists. No, argue with them. I want to hear you.
That it could lead to a very serious spiraling out of control
of
the entire
states,
market.
It absolutely could. It absolutely could. Although, remember, what would happen in those states would be what New York was before the Affordable Care Act, where New York had guaranteed issue and it had community rate and community ratings for the individual market, but it did not have subsidies and it did not have price control. So insurance was available to anybody that wanted it and community rated, but ungodly expensive. And I don't think any of us would
argue. But no mandate in New York.
I'm sorry, no mandate. Well, no mandates in all
that's,
audits. So,
that's
no,
a big
but,
deal.
But everybody would qualify for a hardship exemption, according to the law, if the prices went up high enough. So the vast majority of people, the mandate would no longer apply to. I mean,
guys, rewind. Hold on. What are we talking about? I am doing a radio program here.
Okay. So,
and not everybody, and Mario and Eric and Aaron know a lot about this.
If the law, if the court finds with King or Burwell, I don't even know what's King, and says that that the subsidies that in all of the state-based exchanges, in all the exchanges that are run by the federal government, no longer people would no longer get subsidies. They would no longer get help to buy the insurance. That's what would happen. So in a significant number of states, people would no longer get help buying insurance, and insurance would suddenly become completely unaffordable for up to like 90% of people who are getting insurance, who are getting subsidies.
And they're doing this. They're going to do that, and two courts already have, on the basis of a legal argument that is completely frivolous.
So let me just explain quickly what will happen, and then I absolutely want to turn everything over to you for the legal and everything else. But so they would no longer get subsidies, which means that a lot of those people would no longer be able to buy insurance. We can talk about the individual mandate saying they have to, but there's a hardship exemption in the law that says if the premiums constitute more than a certain percentage of your income, the individual mandate does not apply to you. And almost all those people would then qualify for the hardship exemption because insurance would be very expensive. It would be more than the amount. They couldn't afford it. And at that point, only sick people would want to buy insurance. It would drive prices way up. But it doesn't have to become an immediate death spiral because, again, that's what New York was before the law was passed, where you could get insurance and you could get community ratings, but it was very, very expensive. And therefore, only rich people on the individual market or people who were sick found the money to go out and buy the insurance. It's not optimal. It's terrible, in fact. It will leave millions, something like 5 million people or so, immediately uninsured who were not before. I absolutely deplore the outcome, but New York was not like failing and did not have a death spiral and did not immediately go in the tank before the Affordable Care Act was passed. It was not
Aaron,
anything.
One comment about that, though. One comment about that, or a question, I should say. One question about that. Having grown up in New York, I understand New York a little bit, and having been in Georgia now for a long time, I think New York's infrastructures overall in the health – New York is not Arkansas, and New York is not all the red states.
Let's take a deep breath. Is this worse than pre-ACA in Arkansas?
I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer.
I'm saying, in other words, what would make it worse? Why would it be – it would be harder –
Well, one thing that you pointed out in the past, which I think is accurate, is it's one thing for someone never to have something.
Mm-hmm.
It's something else.
Oh, politically, this will be a nightmare. What I'm saying, though, in other words, is why would the insurance market, all that would happen is basically the insurance companies would be like, we're only going to offer super expensive policies for people that want to buy them.
It's a real shame the Supreme Court is going to take 5.5 million people and make them uninsured. Based on a frivolous thing.
Oh, my God. No one should take that. I'm saying this is not a terrible outcome. I'm saying I don't believe this will destroy the ACA.
Sure. Guys, this leads me into my question perfectly.
Okay.
So being that you believe that they're going to rule against the government for King.
I'm not sure of that, though. So Eric is much more sure of that.
I'm talking about Eric. Eric, you said that they're going
I'd bet a lot of money. I would bet a lot of money on that.
I'd bet against you. But let's say they do. So the most likely, the decision would be handed down in, June of 15, right? Late
most
June?
Most likely, yes.
And so this is in the middle of people's policies while they're receiving subsidies, right? So my question is, I don't know how the Supreme Court operates in this fashion, but would they be able to grant a delay or a stay?
That's a great question,
to give the
Eric.
Congress or the states a chance to remedy it?
So Jonathan Adler at Case Western and Nicholas Bagley, who's been on this show and works with Aaron, I think, at Michigan, had a debate about this on Twitter.
They've had a number of debates, one of which was at University of Michigan. They've debated at least three times on this, and if people really want to get into weeds and watch – Bagley versus Adler. It's. I haven't watched it, but they've debated in a couple different venues now, more than Twitter, which is obviously a horrid place to debate.
On this very point, it was interesting to see what each of them did. Adler, who wants the law struck down with every fiber of his molecules, Adler suggested
it wouldn't have to take effect immediately, and maybe they could give a delay to work out what's going to happen. Bagley, who wants the law upheld with all of his molecules and feelings, took kind of the opposite position, though neither one took a strong position. And the answer to your question, Mario, is the Supreme Court can do whatever the hell it wants to do on this. So it could issue a decision and say effective today. My prediction is they won't do that. My prediction is they'll issue a decision and make up some crazy legal argument for a delay and say, even though it's illegal, you have 2 months. And they've done this before. Back in 1983, the Supreme Court struck down as a constitutional matter all of the United States bankruptcy courts, which threw everything into turmoil. But they said, Congress, you have 6 months to fix this. And so there's precedent, even in a constitutional case, which this is
But let me, I mean, we've already seen Republicans say they don't want to fix this. But my question is a political one, and Mario brings up a really interesting point about the date of when the Supreme Court may decide this. If it is in June 15, that doesn't necessarily have a huge effect on November 16. But my question is, my question is about the politics, and it's, you know, we're not experts on politics, although we are as much as anybody else. And that is, why would Republicans and Adler and others want to do this? Don't they know politically that this could or wouldn't
so,
this
so I
politically?
Talked to Adler about this.
Would say he's a Republican.
Here's the thing.
But Republicans want this. They're bringing this case, aren't they?
Pete, forget about this case. Forget about King versus Burwell for a minute. There have been legal challenges to the Affordable Care Act on the basis that the mandate was unconstitutional, the Medicaid part of the law was unconstitutional. There's another challenge in lower courts saying the entire law violates something called the Origination Clause. I won't even bore you with that. But if that was upheld, the entire law goes away. And there's this challenge. There is and has been from the day the law was passed a conspiracy, and I'm using that word not in the criminal context. The name of the blog is the Volokh Conspiracy. The name of the book is the conspiracy. There's been a conspiracy to end this law by very smart, very prominent law professors for reasons having everything to do with libertarianism and anti-big government and nothing to do with the specifics of this law. And they are powerful, smart people who have a lot of powerful, smart backers, including the Washington Post right now. Because the Washington Post owns the Volokh conspiracy now. And their motivation is completely anti-federal government. That's what it is.
Can I make a counterintuitive point about the politics? I think we did this last time, and Aaron laughed at me. But
I never laugh at you. Just
Aaron does.
I don't know.
About the legislative fix. So they just got elected, right? You know they're going to want to get rid of the medical device tax. They want to attack the employer mandate. There's no way in the world Obama signs any of that stuff without technical fixes. So you think for the next 8 months they're just going to give up totally on making any changes on the chance that they get a favorable decision in SCOTUS?
Well, again, it's also you have to view – everybody's always panicked and worried about Congress, and Congress is going to do this. You have to remember that for the most part, the federal government, people working in the federal government are – you know, whether or not this happens and which states it hurts doesn't matter. What this is going to be a real problem for are the state governments, because that's where the people are going to get hurt. So you're already seeing a couple states that are positioning themselves for, even if the Supreme Court decides this, how are we going to fix it? Because they don't want to deal with the political repercussions of all of a sudden having broken local insurance markets, their hospital systems struggling, you know, doctors losing their minds, pharmaceutical companies all over them because they can't get money for the patients anymore. So, you know, business is not for this fix. And locally, state by state, they're going to be hammering them. So it will be hard for governors. It will be hard for state legislators. They're the ones that are going to feel the brunt of this. So that's where I think fixes are going to come originally. Eventually, we may get around to a congressional fix, but I would not be optimistic of that happening.
Justice Roberts is going to do two things in this case. He loves sound bites, and Jonathan Adler has positioned this case for a sound bite argument. Established by a state means a state, so Congress can't do it. But the second thing Roberts is going to do is he's going to say, this is not a big deal for the Supreme Court. Congress can fix this. He's going to say, we're not making a constitutional decision. All Congress has to do to fix this is amend the law. And it's such a deplorably false, fraudulent argument. But he's going to make it anyway.
Let me get to Keith in New York.
Hi there.
Keith, sorry. He tweeted me. He goes, can I come into your echo chamber? Stir it up, sir.
Look, Jonathan Adler's argument
is based on philosophy. And whether or not you like the particular philosophy, that is certainly not even close to the worst thing to base an argument on. And the point here is
for judges, Keith, you're wrong about that. You're wrong about that. Adler is making a legal statutory interpretation argument that is frivolous. And that's been the greenhouse word.
It is certainly not.
No, wait, Keith, based on philosophy.
Let me tell you why. The people that created this, and there's video of people talking, which obviously you've seen before.
Really?
Hold on.
Pete, hang up on him.
Can I finish this sentence?
No, I'm not going to hang up on him. Quickly.
Can I just finish this sentence? Gruber is legally irrelevant. It makes no difference.
Hold on. Aaron Carroll just made the argument that if this case turns, there will be immense pressure on the states to go and create exchanges or make a fix. The fact is they drafted this law with language in one particular important place that says exchange created by the state.
No, you're wrong. The federal government can create such an exchange. Such an exchange. Not even an. Such exchange. Keith, they didn't. And by the way, Adler is not responding to this from last night. It doesn't say such an exchange or a similar exchange. It says Secretary shall create such exchange, meaning the exact same one. That's what it says. Such
and Adler has never
persuasively answered that claim.
And I asked Adler on Twitter whether or not a state could basically create an exchange as a shell and fill it with the federal government's exchange, and he said depending on how they do it, yes, they can.
All right, 1 minute left. Last words, Aaron.
So, again, it's like we covered – I have no argument because people are going back and sort of trying to do – you know, we're acting as if we can try to figure out what people were thinking as if they were dead. They're alive. And it wasn't that long ago, and you can go back and watch all the debates, all the clips, every CBO scoring, all the news coverage of the law as it was being debated, and at no point did anyone – involved in the writing of the law or on the news, other than Gruber, sort of, and I don't care what he said behind the scenes, none of it showed this kind of intent. None of it. And
well
I agree
well
that it
said,
exists in the law, but none of it.
Well, Aaron's exactly right. And even if they, and it doesn't matter anyway, because such federal government having the power to create such exchange creates enough ambiguity for the IRS rule to be reasonable.
All right. Well, everybody was reasonable today. How about that? Thank you. @AaronE. Carroll @ESpinSiegel.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you, guys.